little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics. And my name is Bob Frelick, here with the other host of Thinking Clearly, Julia Minton. Hey, Julia.
Hi, Bob.
We've got a great guest all connected up here with us for this episode of Thinking Clearly. So we want to get right to that, but let's not leave out letting folks know how they can get in touch with us and pop up our previously archived podcast versions of Thinking Clearly.
Yeah, folks can find us on the internet, like many things. We are on Facebook, Thinking Clearly Radio. Just put it in the search bar, it should come right up. We are also podcasted. You can open up your favorite podcast app and search for Thinking Clearly, or visit thinkingclearly.libsyn.com for our entire archive going back 5 years now.
Doesn't seem like 5 years, does it? Does it seem like 5 years to you?
Does it seem longer or shorter to you, Bob? Because I'm not sure which.
Okay. Well, why don't you tell folks what we're up to on this episode of Thinking Clearly?
Yeah, well, at today's Thinking Clearly, we're going to be talking about the role of critical thinking in making important decisions, issues in teaching and learning critical thinking, and how the merging of creative thinking and critical thinking leads to better strategic thinking.
And our guest for this episode of Thinking Clearly is Army Colonel Stephen Garris, who, although he is now retired from the Army, is currently a professor of behavioral sciences at the Army War College, where he teaches a number of courses, including several electives in critical thinking and judgment, and core courses in strategic leadership and management. And Professor Garris completed his master's degree and PhD in industrial and organizational psychology at Penn State University, and he has a long list of publications and presentations that he's made, and is also the co-author of several monographs to include the widely circulated Lying to Ourselves, Dishonesty in the Army Profession. Steve Garris, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Hey, thanks to Bob and Julia. I'm excited to be here and excited to have a conversation about my favorite topic.
We've been trying to get you on this show for quite a while. It was about a year ago that a listener to the podcast suggested your name. And so we're really happy to finally meet you and get a chance to have a discussion with you. Well, Julia has the first question to start us off, but I want to note that we are pre-recording this interview, so there's not going to be any listener call-ins for this edition of Thinking Clearly.
Yeah, so thanks again so much for joining us, and just want to put out there, too, further evidence that we do listen to our listeners and appreciate their suggestions. So we're glad you could join us today. To start us off, as Bob mentioned, you have a PhD in industrial and organizational psychology. When did you become interested in the topic of critical thinking, and what prompted your interest in teaching it to others?
Well, the short answer is I was told to. A little background's in order here. So I graduated from the Army War College in 2002, and I was assigned to Ankara, Turkey for 2 years, a really interesting place and a really interesting time, as you can imagine. Following those 2 years, I got assigned back to the Army War College, this time as a faculty. And in the first month or so, my department head came into my office and said, "Hey, Steve, we got a vacancy for teaching our elective in critical thinking. Are you interested in doing it?" And, you know, when you're new to an organization in the military and when your boss asks you to do something, it really is not a question. So my answer, of course, was, "Sure, I'd love to." And I distinctly remember that after he left my office, I turned on my computer and Googled critical thinking to see what it was. That's a true story. But what's really interesting, after reading, spending a couple hours reading the multitude of definitions on critical thinking, and they were quite varied, and reading a couple papers on it, with each reading, I just started getting really excited, because I knew, one, that nobody could put me in a corner on this, and I could kind of do what I wanted. And what I wanted to do was create an elective that would hopefully inform these students so that they wouldn't commit the same errors I had seen in the 12 years since I had achieved my PhD. So in military, like most organizations, you sit in meetings, and even in Turkey at the strategic level, I would sit in meetings and think, my gosh, I wish I could explain to them about biases and social cognition and some psychology stuff, because we're really, really not performing as well as we could. So I just got incredibly excited about it. I created the elective from scratch. I refined it over the years, and I've given close to 100 lectures on it around the world. It has just become my passion.
Well, that's great. That's a wonderful story. It's kind of like a dream come true. Then you wind up with a job that you really like and really love, and something that you're passionate about. That's great.
Yeah, it really is. And I did it for 3 years as a colonel, and then I retired in 2007, and I've been a civilian professor in the last 13 years now.
Uh-huh.
14 years.
Have you taught in university or anywhere else besides the Army College?
Yes. So when I was a young infantry captain, the Army decided to send me to graduate school at Penn State, like you mentioned, for 3 years to get my master's and my doctorate, which was quite a painful experience in that timeline. And then I went to West Point, where I ended up as the director of their leadership curriculum as a young major, and then left there and went back in 1995 back out to do Army things until I showed up here as a student in 2001, graduating in 2002. So I taught at West Point for 3 years.
A statement from a 2009 paper that you co-authored. It was in the Journal of Military Review, and it reads like this. This is the quote: "The core elements of strategic thinking are the ability to think creatively and critically about national security issues. We believe research in cognitive psychology, neuroscience, and decision-making can and should inform the Army's calculus for developing strategic thinking skills." That's the end of the quote. Later on, we'll get into some of the specifics of the model that you actually use in teaching critical thinking. But for now, just give us kind of a general idea of your approach to helping develop those strategic thinking skills in the military's future leaders, including the role of critical thinking in your approach and what the challenges are.
Yeah, so I'm probably going to go in a couple of directions here. Stop me if I'm boring you. But when you talk, much like critical thinking, when you look up strategic thinking, you're going to get a bunch of definitions. So the business school people, you know, the Mintzberg centric folks are going to look at it one way. If you bring in national security people, historians, and political scientists, they're going to define it in a completely different way. I just thought it was probably fair to put out what I think is a reasonable definition, which for strategic thinking to me is the ability to synthesize and imagine the effects of relevant factors in pursuit of a strategy to achieve enterprise sustainable competitive advantage. So it's about thinking holistically and applying a bunch of cognitive skills to win, not only in the short term, but in the long term. And I think you could argue that developing strategic thinking skills is the most important task for the Army War College. So why is that? Well, number one, it's a complex world out there, from, you know, traditional wars to cyber and space, non-state actors, to things that China and Russia are doing. At home, we have civil military relations complexities. We have sexual harassment and assault challenges that we deal with on an hourly basis, suicide issues. So our graduates are going to go out there into a really complex world where they're going to have to exercise strategic thinking. Secondly, the Army, unlike a large corporation, we just can't go out and hire a new general officer off the streets. We have to grow our own strategic thinkers. And this process literally starts when our officers are prior to getting commissioned, they're cadets at West Point or an officer candidate school or an ROTC. For instance, the chief of staff of the United States Army in 2060 is probably a cadet at Wake Forest or West Point or South Carolina State. So the development decisions that the Army makes today with those cadets is how we're going to groom these strategic thinking skills for somebody who's going to face a world in 2060 that doesn't look anything like it does right now. So it's quite a challenge. Third, somewhat analogous to large corporations, prior to arrival at the War College, officers spend almost all their time at the tactical level. They're experts at direct level leadership with bounded short time horizons, often requiring ridiculous amounts of courage and resilience, as you can imagine. But after the War College, most of our graduates serve in positions requiring a nonlinear increase in strategic thinking. They face really complex, wicked problems in environments where they have to build teams of people with disparate backgrounds to gather information and make decisions. The hierarchical structure they are most comfortable with is usually gone, and we have to prepare them for this world. And finally, while just one of the main cognitive skills required of strategic thinking, the critical thinking skills that we're going to talk about over the next 40 or 50 minutes is really foundational to strategic thinking. So hopefully that scratches the itch on strategic thinking, Bob.
Yeah, that does a good scratch. It makes me think that critical thinking and creative thinking are taught in the California Common Core and the K-12 system. Both of those are in their standard, but they never use the word strategic. Strategic to me has more of the meaning of you have a goal that you're trying to accomplish, and your thinking is kind of wrapping around towards meeting that goal. Was there any of that in that too? And is that why the word strategic is kind of more important in something like the Army War College than it might be otherwise?
Well, yeah. So, yeah. And there's a couple of ways, again, you could talk about strategic. So in the military, we will oftentimes break the environment into three levels: the tactical level, the operational level, and the strategic level. And the strategic level is the much more complex, much more uncertain, much more interagency in between countries, as opposed to the tactical and the operational level, where you generally are hanging around people that are wearing military uniforms of some sort. So it's an ends-driven process. The goal that you just mentioned is appropriate, but the environment is just so much different when you do strategic thinking. And there's just no way you can walk into the strategic level and say, yeah, I've done this before. I got it. I know what I'm doing. You are going to have to solicit information from lots of people, oftentimes whose ends are not aligned with yours, and you're going to have to manage those relationships in a way which hopefully leads to a better outcome or a better solution.
On our show, we've talked to a number of professors and teachers from various universities and institutions. I'd be curious to hear from you how teaching critical thinking is or isn't different at the War College.
Yeah, so I guess to the extent that traits influence critical thinking, you can imagine we have a much narrower population that's been filtered by 20 years of military culture. So the student in the Army War College, it does not look like a regular university student. Additionally, compared to a standard university student, our students have incredibly rich frames of reference to capitalize on during instruction. As you can imagine, the deep frames of reference often come with entrenched beliefs on specific topics that probably present some challenges to effective critical thinking. But I'm just thinking about some students I had last year. One had been the aide to the President of the United States. Another had been, on really the very tippy end of the spear, if you were to talk about Joint Special Operations Command or Ranger Operations. And they've been all over the world. And so you have really, really interesting conversations where you as the instructor or the facilitator are oftentimes learning as much as you are as you're facilitating or teaching. And having taught at West Point, it wasn't that way. At West Point, you were trying to, use Socratic method to develop cadets, but they just didn't have a lot in their closet, if you will, to hang on the hooks like these students do. I don't know if you want me to, I can do a real quick what is a War College, if that helps or if you sure think it's appropriate. If not, we can move on.
Yeah, most people don't really know that, so let's go ahead with it.
Yeah, I'm at the Army War College. There's a Navy War College, a Air Force War College, a National War College, and a couple other similar organizations. Ours, the Army's the biggest. To get here, our officers go through a board selection process where a panel of very senior officers will go through their personnel files. And I don't really know exactly the number. Maybe the top 8 or 10% of the senior lieutenant colonels and colonels are selected to come to the War College. And they'll be here for 10 months of a pretty intense experience. They leave with a master in strategic studies, We have officers from the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines, the Coast Guard, a bunch of defense civilians. And what I think most people don't know, and what's really interesting, so if we have 380 to 400 students a year, 80 of them will be international officers, usually from about 75 different countries. So you get all kinds of perspectives in your seminars that really makes it interesting. And so what people also don't understand, and I didn't really understand until I got here, was, while most countries or many countries might not have a Navy or an Air Force, they're landlocked or they literally can't afford a fighter jet, every country has an Army. So the fact that they send their international fellows to, you know, what is the world superpower, they're usually sent in their best officers, and we develop these long-term relationships with people throughout the world that we can then capitalize on, whether we're doing peacekeeping operations or training, or if we have to go to war, we'll know the people in those countries. So it's a really interesting experience, and it really relates to critical thinking. In my elective, I ensure I have two or three international officers every time I teach, because I need them there to provide different perspectives. And so that's kind of the War College, Army War College, I should say.
That's very interesting. I was unfamiliar with that. I've certainly heard of West Point, but it sounds like a very different type of institution. If I could be candid, I imagine that we probably have listeners thinking to themselves, the military isn't normally associated with free thinking or critical thinking. I'd be curious to hear how attitudes about critical thinking may be different in your institutions than they are maybe in the civilian world. And if you're ever faced perhaps with resistance to teaching critical thinking skills.
Yeah, so that's a complex question, although it shouldn't be. But what I'll tell you initially is the Army and the military have placed a profound emphasis on the importance of critical thinking. And you don't have to take my word for that. You could Google any major military document in terms of what's in the first couple of paragraphs. It's probably going to have the word develop critical thinking skills. So there's a lot of energy from the students to develop and refine their critical thinking skills. The seats in my elective for 17 years have always been full, and there's usually a waiting list. So there's an energy and a demand for it. Now, what does that mean? So oftentimes a student will show up in my elective in March and they'll say something like, "Oh, all the other students in my seminar said I should take critical thinking." And they say it proudly. And I'm sitting there thinking, is it because you weren't thinking well, or because they think you're going to demonstrate how to do it properly? So you don't really quite know. But I do think that stereotypes of the military as kind of a very narrow-minded group of people who just follow orders. Yeah, it's just not that way anymore, especially after 20 years in Iraq and Afghanistan and counterinsurgency, where starting at the time you're a second lieutenant, a 22-year-old, you've got 40 people in your platoon and you're sitting on an outpost in eastern Afghanistan. You are on your own to use good thinking skills, hopefully good critical thinking skills, in order to accomplish your tasks and protect your people. I'm not going to tell you that, you know, this is like Google or, you know, a California-based, internet company in the military. But I think, in fact, I don't even have to say I think it. So each year in June, we bring in about 180, 200 civilians to spend a week in our seminars. And the one requirement is that you have no affiliation with the military. And so I've gotten to hear the feedback of 16 or 17 years of this from civilians who are Wall Street people, or they're a minister in Iowa, or they're a farmer in Texas, or they work for a large corporation in California. And they go away from a week of spending with these students often saying, "I absolutely did not realize how thoughtful, informed, talented, passionate our soon-to-be senior leaders in the military are." And I'm not trying to sell it. We still have a lot of obstacles. But I think when people are exposed to senior military leaders, that stereotype goes away pretty quickly.
I believe you that in the modern military, that critical thinking is a part of normal training, but you are actually there to teach people something new or to give them another perspective or to add to what they already know in critical thinking. And these are folks, if I'm getting this right, that are already seasoned in kind of normal military decision making, which you're there to expand on that. Is there any resistance to that? There are people that kind of come up to you and say, you know what, this kind of violates the way I normally make decisions. Is there seem to be a resistance there that you have to break through?
Yeah, so that's harder to answer, Bob, than you think, because my guess is there are people who want to stay in what they're very comfortable with. And what I would tell you is they don't typically approach me and say, hey, I want to stay, you know, kind of linear and stupid, and I don't want to learn about looking at things from other perspectives, even if they feel that way. But at the same time, you know, teaching and developing critical thinking skills, as I'm sure you've talked about with other people, it's just not that easy. And so I can sit there and watch some students do it quite well and some students struggle. But I don't think it's because they're locked in a narrow military mindset. I think it oftentimes comes down to personality and just life experiences and life philosophy, if you will.
Okay, good. And that transitions us into the next question, which is just not necessarily in the setting that you're teaching critical thinking, but teaching critical thinking in any setting based on your experience. What do you think students really struggle most with to learn and to master and to use consistently?
Yeah, so I exist at the intersection of theory and practice, as you can imagine. But I'm, interestingly or not surprisingly, I'm 100% sure that all of my students will be exercising judgment on complex and important issues within weeks of graduating. And this fact serves as a constant motivation for me to ensure that my pedagogical style aligns with the adult learning literature. You know, it has to be interesting, useful, relevant, et cetera. In terms of what the students struggle with, and I've heard you mention this book in a previous podcast, I agree with Julia Galef in her Scout Mindset book, and she says that our judgment isn't limited by knowledge nearly as much as it is limited by attitude. And I have found the same thing. So, you know, as I mentioned before, I've done lots of critical thinking presentations. I'm at the point now where the ratio of time I spend on self-awareness to, you know, pure content, think about biases or fallacies or something like that, is about 4-1, because I tend to agree with her that it's all about the attitude. On the things that my students have entrenched beliefs about, they literally use their impressive intellectual horsepower to figure out a way to maintain their beliefs, sometimes in the face of science, logic, and reason. And we all do this. Everyone does it. But as you can imagine, we don't want our senior national security professionals to do that. So we spend a lot of time on it. But I guess the short answer is it's not so much that I teach them what the availability heuristic is or insufficient anchor adjustment or false dichotomy. It's spending a lot of time trying to get them to understand how people think and why oftentimes we have these barriers to being good critical thinkers. And that is sometimes a Sisyphus-like challenge, but it's worth it because when they get better, they'll write you back an email a year or two or 5 years later and say, "Wow, it really made a difference." So you know, I don't know if you I'm sure you've talked about this with other people. I don't know if me talking about Galef saying it's more attitude than content is that a surprise to you, or do you agree, disagree, or what do you think about that?
Definitely not a surprise. As Daniel Kahneman has said a number of times, the author of Thinking Fast and Slow, and one of the pioneers studying heuristics and biases, has said as much as he understands in depth these issues, he still is subject to biases, and as we all are. So definitely a sort of a personal approach and maybe even a values clarification kind of situation to help a person uncover what some of their biases are would be a good approach. Do you use, since Julia Galef came out with that book and those metaphors, scout versus soldier mindset, do you use that at all? And have you incorporated that metaphor?
Bob, this is your big contribution here. So I listened to a couple of podcasts in prep for this, and you mentioned that book, which I had not heard of. So I bought it, and I read it, I loved it. I listened to a couple of her podcasts, and very sharp. So I have definitely, there's two lessons I've already built it into my elective for next year.
Oh,
and so I'm thankful for you for that. I will say, though, so as someone who spent almost 2 years as a scout platoon leader, as a lieutenant, her dichotomy on scout and soldier to a military person, yeah, it doesn't really, the way she describes it, good to go. But, you know, all scouts in the Army, for instance, are soldiers first. And once they're done being in a scout unit, they go back to a soldier unit. So it's not a bimodal distribution of a scout mindset versus a soldier mindset. I think when you're in a scout role, you're primed to make sure you're telling the truth, because if you don't, you're going to get the whole unit killed. I think soldiers want to do that too, but usually they're, you know, four levels down and they're not out on the boundaries, if you will. But I absolutely loved her book. And again, it might be the first time that somebody spent that much time acknowledging that it's the attitude, right? So, you know, in my elective, I spend 12, 15 hours on biases and fallacies. And I can get people to get pretty good at that. But if I'm giving you an hour or 2 hours, you know, in a presentation, I would rather focus on attitude and self-awareness, because you are not going to develop your ability to recognize availability heuristic or something along those lines.
Great. Well, let's zoom out just a little bit, sticking with the same question, but zooming out a little bit. What's your opinion, and I ask this of many people, why there's such a lack of critical thinking in all of our information streams, no matter what setting we're talking about?
Yeah, I'm sure you've talked about this before, and I you know, that's a complex answer, and I could probably talk a long time on that. But remember, I'm an organizational psychologist, so the one thing I'll start off with is I think the evolutionary psychologists would probably assert that we're hardwired for survival and not for critical thinking, right? So we quickly categorize, we look for confirming information, we prefer winning to being right. And let's face it, we're often intellectually lazy. We're conserving energy to go kill the mastodon or do cave paintings or something along those lines. But when you combine that with an ability to receive information from preferred news sources, for instance, you have a recipe for poor critical thinking. The one thing I will add to that, and I'm in a unique position to assess this somewhat, a lot of it is culture. So when I look for bringing those international fellows into my elective, I'm really hoping I'm getting officers from Western Europe, from British Commonwealth countries, from Nordic countries, because they tend to have cultures that, one, are better at critical thinking, and two, they're willing to tell U.S. military officers when they disagree with them. So I'm sure there's a lot of other countries out there, a lot of Asian countries, where their critical thinking skills are quite good, but their culture isn't that they're going to tell U.S. people, hey, you're wrong on this. Whereas if you get the French officer in your seminar, he's going to love to tell you that you're wrong. But in terms of developing your U.S. students, your American students, it's a great thing to have. But I don't think American culture is on the cutting edge of critical thinking skills. So, you know, even if everyone started developing critical thinking skills, which we assert that we're doing in schools, they're walking out into a culture every day that generally doesn't value getting to the truth and logic, science, and reason, if you will. I don't know if that sounds like something you've heard before, but that's where I'm at on that.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting you mentioned that your work is at the intersection of theory and practice. Along those lines, it would seem that forecasting future events would be a big part of education and training at the War College. I imagine you might be familiar with Philip Tetlock's work on super forecasters. Could you briefly explain to our listeners what super forecasting is? And do you use any part of Tetlock's work in your courses at the War College?
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about that. So, not only super forecasting, but Tetlock's earlier book called Expert Political Judgment is kind of a Bible for me in terms of understanding judgment and thinking about forecasting. So what he would say, he had a co-author for Super Forecasting. I can't remember the name, but he would probably assert that most people are terrible forecasters. But there are some people who are really good at it. And they tend to show some common attributes. For instance, they gather evidence from multiple sources. They think probabilistically, which means you got to kind of be comfortable with numbers and math. They often work in teams. They aggregate perspectives. They keep score, as he talks a lot about in his expert political judgment book. They make reputational bets. They admit error and change their minds. You have to be self-critical. And I think what Tetlick would say about these super forecasters is that updating their beliefs is more important than, you know, raw cognitive ability, if you will. So it's, again, it goes back to attitude. His expert political judgment book, he talks about foxes and hedgehogs, which comes from a early 1950s Isaiah Berlin piece on Tolstoy. But he says foxes are better forecasters, and foxes know many things. But hedgehogs, they know one big thing really well. And so I talk about it at the War College in terms of updating beliefs. I integrate a lot of Tetlock's concepts into some papers that we use for curriculum reading. Interestingly, we teach our students in seminars of 16 or 15 students with three or four faculty, and the faculty are very multidisciplinary, which I think would lead to better forecasting because you're getting more unique, less stovepipe perspectives. Another thing we do here is we have what's called the Senior Leader Feedback Program, where all this, or just about all the students will do a bunch of surveys and personality assessment things and 360 degree things, where they'll then sit down with somebody for a couple hours who will walk them through what their blind spots are. And when you see the feedback and what the blind spots are, it aligns with developing better forecasting skills. The one other thing I would say on that, Julia, is one thing you probably haven't thought about is that, remember, we're teaching senior military officers, right, generally, and we have a challenge because we need to develop leaders who are both humble enough to seek other perspectives, admit when they're wrong, and change their minds, and at the same time, they've got to portray self-confidence and decisiveness. I mean, it's really critical for strategic thinking. You don't want to say, you know, general, should we go left or right? And they go, well, I don't know. What do you guys think? We could do that. It doesn't work that way. People get scared. They want somebody who's going to say, well, before I make a decision, I want your perspectives. Please tell me, please, you know, and give me some probabilities on this. If you're doing it in a tech locking fashion, and then they say, we're going left and we're going to do great. And I'm going to lead the way. So it's a giant balance between, the fox and the hedgehog to be a military officer at any level, to include the senior level. And Tetlock would talk about some of the strengths of the hedgehog, which aren't the great forecasters, but they're really good in unfavorable environments where the signal to noise ratio is not very good. And think about combat. They're very persistent in the face of adversity. There's a book that came out maybe 3 or 4 years ago, and it was co-authored by someone named Admiral Stavridis, former Supreme Allied Commander of Europe, called The Leadership Bookshelf, where he basically sent an email to all of his four-star friends and said, what's your favorite leadership book and what do you get out of it? And when you read through that, one of the main common attributes that these generals identify is persistence, which sounds a whole lot more like a hedgehog than a fox, and yet we know that the best forecasters are those open-minded people that change their mind. So it's a challenge that's not going to go away. We definitely integrate it into our curriculum. I put it in most of my papers. I just was overwhelmed by both of Tetlock's books that I've read.
Later on, after his work on super forecasting, Tetlock also became interested in the use of counterfactual thinking. Do you incorporate any of that part of Tetlock's contributions?
Yeah. So, and if we have time, I'll talk a little bit about my critical thinking model. But one of the things I'll emphasize is that when we're teaching students to challenge assumptions, probably the number one area that we want them to look at, and they're not that comfortable looking at because nobody wants to challenge their deep beliefs and assumptions, but are assumptions about causality. And we give them a multicultural framework to look at. And one of the four lenses we ask them to look at is through counterfactuals. And we also asked them to look at, you know, kind of correlational data, because it doesn't mean it's causal, but it's not a bad place to start. We asked them to look at dispositional factors and physicalism factors, which military people are very comfortable with. But we really spend time, and this goes back to the strategic thinking discussion. We'd spend time trying to get them to look at complex adaptive systems and understand causality and challenge their assumptions. And I have not looked at what Tetlock has talked about with counterfactuals, but I have read a lot about counterfactual thinking. So much like the Scout mindset, Bob, you've given me another thing I got to go read.
Can you just briefly describe for our listeners what a counterfactual is?
So if you're thinking about the causes of World War One, because you don't want that to happen again, well, if the Archduke hadn't gone to Sarajevo and been assassinated, we wouldn't have had World War One. So the key thing there is you take the lesson you want. The problem, of course, is there were probably a whole bunch of other things that could have started World War One. And you, as a strategic thinker, you're trying to understand causality, but you can't say if you pull one thing away, then you know the train would have gone off the tracks and something wouldn't have happened. So it requires complex thinking. It's basically if we pulled something out, then some event would not have happened. I apologize for not having an immediate definition of counterfactual in front of me, but maybe you could help me
it's not a pop quiz.
Yeah, and that's okay. But I think it's important to sort of reiterate to folks that this is a natural ability, again, a natural evolved ability that we have as human beings, and that we do it naturally. We use counterfactuals all the time when we say, I wish I would have done or said something else. You know, it's a natural kind of thing. We go back and rehash what we've done and what we've said, and we try to imagine how things would have come out differently if we would have acted differently or if the situation would have been different. So it's a very wonderful human cognitive ability that we all have that is kind of underutilized in terms of decision-making a lot of times. We do it post-fact, you know, after the fact, rather than before the fact of trying to figure out what all the different scenarios could be. So I can see where it fits very well into strategic thinking.
Yeah, and we do, you know, you probably maybe talk to people about red teaming and pre-mortem analysis where you said, all right, we're going to make a big decision here. It's 3 months from now and this thing turned out poorly. Let's talk about why that happened. Let's write some narratives. And you're basically doing some counterfactual thinking to say, well, what happened? The environment changed, or we got cut funding, or our key leader left, or something along those lines. And it's an important way to red team potential courses of action or potential solutions for complex problems.
And the other thing I was thinking is because in a military setting, like you said, sometimes decisions have to be made very, very quickly, and you don't get a chance to do the analytic slow thinking that we talk a lot about on this show. It makes me think of Gary Klein. Gary Klein is another psychologist who did a paper, a wonderful paper with Daniel Kahneman, because they were both coming from completely different points of view. And we had Gary Klein on as a guest, and his expertise is in trained expertise. Right. He believes in the power of intuition, but not seeing intuition as some magical thing that connects somehow with the cosmos and delivers a wonderful answer to us, but that intuition needs to be trained through feedback as to how our decisions came out. So I wonder if you thought about anything like that in terms of trained expertise.
When I built my model for critical thinking, the first thing I wanted to do was talk about intuition versus critical thinking, or intuition versus control thinking. And so what you don't probably appreciate, and I can't imagine how you would, is failing an Army War College experience, most senior military leaders, like most corporate leaders, I would point out, would say, oh, I might trust my intuition much more than anything else I get, right? So you can send the staff to go do some work and give them 6 months, and they'll come back and say, we should pick course of action B. But if the senior leader's intuition says course of action A, they're going to go with course of action A. And what we spend a lot of time on, especially in my critical thinking elective, is pushing people off of intuition and more into doing critical thinking. So while I don't really, and I've read Klein's stuff, and I think, as Dan Kahneman would say, if the environment is stable and you've got the expertise, you go ahead and use that intuition all you like. But as I mentioned when I described strategic thinking, our environment is constantly changing. It's volatile, uncertain, complex, et cetera. So I think Kahneman said, all you're doing is grabbing a memory, right? That's what intuition is. It's a gut feeling based on your memories. Well, the memory you have is to an environment that no longer exists. So yeah, if you're a firefighter or a police officer, or even a lieutenant or a sergeant getting ambushed, we want you to use intuition. And the Army develops that through training and training and training. But when these officers get to the strategic level, they're really comfortable with intuition. And you literally have to push them to say, you know what, I think I know the right answer here, but let me go get some evidence-based metrics, and let me talk to people who I don't like that I know are going to be painful, and maybe develop a completely different perspective of this. So, yeah, I don't mention Klein very often at the War College because everybody would say, that's what we should be doing. Yeah. And I'm like, no. Yeah. Memory recall in non-stable environments is going to get you into trouble.
That does seem like a tricky topic, especially in your line of work. I'm curious to revisit something you said about, you articulated it really well, the difficult balance between confidence in decision making while remaining open-minded and having critical, apply critical thinking to our decisions. I'm just, and this is, of course, a topic that comes up most of the time. I'm curious, really, if you have any advice for people trying to strike that balance. You know, there are times that we need to really take our time and slowly think through things critically, and then there's a time to make decisions and to confidently move forward. What advice would you give people trying to find that balance?
I think you have to figure out what person you will listen to. So one way I've seen development in that that's reasonably effective is when officers have mentors who are probably retired or senior to them, and who can say, hey, let's talk about those two decisions you made. Let's go through those, because it doesn't seem like you had all the information. Were there people in your organization that had that information? Why didn't you go get it? But it almost has to be somebody they respect, and they would be willing, they'd be embarrassed if they kept failing. And oftentimes, and this is not a military-centric issue, it's not going to be your peers or your subordinates. You would wish that were the case. But I think one way I've seen it is to have some kind of mentoring system where you go through this. And what the corporate world tends to do is have executive coaches that will walk really talented people through that dilemma and through that balance between humility and confidence. But, you know, I'm not sure I've ever read anything that said they've been incredibly effective at that, because so much of that is deep personality. And oftentimes, I don't think, and Julie, I'd be interested what you think, but people don't get to the senior level if they're not confident, right? So now you get to the senior level and you have a really complex environment where they need to exercise humility and change their minds, but they have been rewarded for their confidence year in and year out. So I think it's generally a unique combination of somebody who can easily go from context to context and know when to be humble, know when to get data, know when to change your mind, or know when to say, my intuition's right on this. I'm very confident in this. This is what we're going to do. I've seen some people do it. And when you're around those people, they just blow you away. They're so impressive. But, you know, I myself struggle with that same challenge.
You've talked a little bit about, and I've alluded to it, your model that you use for critical thinking. In some writings that I've seen of yours, you actually draw this neat little diagram. Well, radio is not very good for diagrams, but I'm going to ask you to sort of, as best you can, without the diagram, summarize what your model of critical thinking is that you use currently.
Okay, so going all the way back to the day when my boss said, hey, you're going to teach the critical thinking elective, you know, I pulled out some previous year's syllabus, and they tended to use some readings from Paulin Elder. I don't know if you've ever seen that stuff or mentioned it, but very, very well known in the critical thinking world. And they have it's not a model. It's basically a list of things that you should question. So when I developed my model, I took what they had and I added the stuff in that was very important to me. And the first thing was, at the time it was automatic versus controlled or serial versus parallel processing, because Kahneman's book hadn't come out yet, but it's really system one and system two. So the model says you have a stimulus. Does it require critical thinking? You know, 95% of the time or whatever, it doesn't. So just go make a decision. But sometimes it does. And part of the challenge of critical thinking is that if you're sure you're right, you're probably going to go across the top of the model and make a decision when, in fact, you probably ought to come down and do some more of this critical or controlled thinking. So that's the first thing that happens. So then you decide, no, we're going to do critical thinking on this. It basically goes from you clarify the concern, which is some, and I'll talk in a second about that after I walk it through very quickly. You evaluate information, you assess implications, and then you make a decision. That's the kind of linear version. And in the middle of it, there are a bunch of clouds where you're supposed to assess multiple points of view and challenge assumptions, question inferences. In the evaluate information piece I put in there, unlike Paulin Elder, that's where I brought in all the Tversky and Kahneman stuff in terms of biases and heuristics. And it's where I put in inductive reasoning and logical fallacies, which if you have a philosopher on, that's what they're going to spend a lot of their time talking about. And the more I'm here, the more I see logical fallacies as just incredibly important for the students to recognize when they see it and when they do it. So the first place to start is clarify concern. And stop me, Bob, if I'm talking too long here. I know we're probably running short on time. A couple things there. One, I think it's where the Army's the weakest. And I tell audiences that all the time. And so what they should be doing is saying, you know, what problem are we trying to solve? But Army culture specifically, we are executors. It's our greatest strength and sometimes our greatest weakness. So if you need someone to distribute COVID or help after a hurricane or go get ISIS, you tell Army and off we go. But unfortunately, I think when we hit really complex problems, we're ready to go without sitting around and really defining the problem and thinking about it. And that's somewhere, that's one of the key critical thinking skills I spend time on in my elective. In terms of evaluate information, it's not only the biases and fallacies. I always try to talk to my students about assessing credibility of the source and using evidence-based decision-making. Go do a study, get data, have hypotheses so that you have a better feel for what's going on. In terms of the implications, of course, it's second and third order effects and unintended consequences. I spend a lot of time with my students talking about inevitable implications because those are the ones that really frustrate me when it almost goes a little bit off of what we were talking about before. But, you know, today an implication, but nobody talks about it because it doesn't support their perspective. But it's inevitable. And if you look at things like No Child Left Behind or Medicare, and people talk about how it's so expensive now. We didn't see it coming that, you know, people were going to live longer. The baby boomers were coming through. When that was passed, all the baby boomers were born, right? And just people don't talk about things because they don't want to have uncomfortable conversations. And in the middle of the model, I talk about point of view. And I often tell audiences, hey, if you only have 40 seconds, the one thing you can do to be a better critical thinker is build a steel man argument against your strong belief. So if you think strongly about X, sit down and write the five bullets about Y so that you're at least somewhat considering them. And then what students often do, and I do it too, when I'm writing those five things, I'm thinking the whole time, well, that's stupid. That's stupid. That doesn't make any sense. And you're writing them out. And then you say, I've done what he told me to. I've done a really good, you know, empathize with other perspectives, but you really haven't. And I tell some anecdotes with my students to try to get them to understand how important that is.
So they actually are building a straw man.
Well, they're not supposed
argument.
To.
No, I know, but they're in their mind, yeah. It's difficult.
But we all do it, right? We all do it. I buy books. I mean, I try to practice what they preach. So I feel pretty strongly about individual issues, and I'll see a book come out and I'll read in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, or review it. And I'll think, that's crazy. I'm going to buy it. And then I read it and I start reading it, going through it, going, oh my gosh, this person's, you know, goofball. And then I say, Steve, you're doing exactly what you tell the students not to do. And one of my phrases with the students is, don't judge, be curious, right? Don't judge, be curious, because you're reading it and you're thinking this person's an idiot. But what you should be saying or thinking, I wonder how they got to these perspectives, and let me, you know, delve a little bit deeper into it. And I say that and I violate that as much as the next person. It's hard to do.
And I see Julia shaking her head, acknowledging that. We've done it.
I don't do that. Not at all. No, of course. That's definitely not sarcasm in my voice at all.
Well, I will acknowledge we've even done it on the air a little bit, but you know, we try to avoid that because it lasts forever that way. Okay, anything else before, I think Julie has another question, but anything else to finish up on your model?
I talked to causality and assumptions, so I won't go that again. I do, Paul and Elder concept is inferences, and I spend time with my students. The second day of school in my base seminar, I will train my students to get in the habit of saying, I infer from what I read, or I infer from what you said, or I infer from your nonverbals that you think X or Y. And people always go, no, that's not what they meant, or that's not what I'm thinking. But of all the really simple critical thinking skills that reduce something called coordination losses is get in the habit of saying I infer, because people assume everyone makes the same inferences they do. And we know that they don't, because they're based on different worldviews, frames of reference, assumptions, et cetera. So we spend a lot of time talking about that also. And I think that pretty much covers it.
It is a very interesting process that you've outlined, and I think it has a lot of interesting insights. You know, and kind of wrapping up our show here, I'm thinking about our listeners who are, I imagine, largely civilians. Maybe some may have a military experience. But I'm curious to hear, you know, your thoughts about the importance of learning and, mastering critical thinking skills, and how you would recommend folks go about doing that, refining their critical thinking skills.
Yeah, so I would say half of the presentations I've given have been to civilian audiences, and they're pretty thirsty to develop critical thinking skills. Of course, what most people think is, you know, that what he's describing is exactly the problem in my organization with everybody but me, right? So I think we all need to work on this. I'll go through a couple of things. I think this might surprise you, but the most important thing you need to do is commit to it. If you're not committed to this, it is so hard that you're going to, you know, the first time you read something that's absolutely untrue but agrees with your views, you're going to scan right over it. I tell my students in my elective the first day, I say, hey, there's 15 of you in here. Five of you are going to get really good at critical thinking. Five of you are going to think you get pretty good at critical thinking, but based on your paper, you know, we got some work to do. And five of you are going to use this for nothing but evil. You literally are only going to identify problems in thinking that disagrees with your own. And then you're going to say, well, I took Steve Garris's critical thinking elective, so I know what I'm talking about. And yeah, it's hard, right? So you have to commit to doing it. If I were advising some of your listeners, I would say you have to read some of the better books on the topic. I would suggest Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow, Jonathan Haidt's The Righteous Mind. Keith Stanovich's What Intelligence Tests Miss, I really like. I really like the book you guys recommended, Galef's The Scout Mindset. And then any basic critical thinking book, I like Diane Halpern's book, Thought and Knowledge. You're going to have to read through those and you know, kind of take a look at this stuff. If you don't have time, Google Garris Critical Thinking, read my 15-page paper that we give to the students here on the second day, and you'll get probably 40% of that. Another thing that might surprise you, I would recommend people take a valid online personality test, like the IPNIO short form, basically to develop your self-awareness. If, like me, you're below average in openness to experience, you're going to probably have to work a little harder at this. And as you can imagine, if you understand Big Five personality, military officers tend to be lower in openness to experience than the norm in society, which means you're not that really eager to change your mind on things, but you can do it when coached well and if you're committed to it. Make a practice of reading articles that conflict with your beliefs. Expand your pool of friends to include people who disagree with you. Remember, don't judge, be curious. I would coach people to travel as much as possible and engage in those countries. And I'll just end with finally, I would say that you should assess each topic individually. Don't let your tribe or your preferred cable news network determine your judgment. You can be against defending the police and for gun control or vice versa. And oftentimes I find in students and the American public that they come at it from their tribe perspective. They don't put the critical thinking into it. And they think that because they're on this side or that side, they have to think the following ways. I think critical thinkers assess each issue individually. I think it's a hallmark of critical, one of the hallmarks of critical thinking. I hope that helps.
That's great. And for a last question, the question is going to be longer than the answer, I think, but because I want to set the context and just get a brief answer from you. A lot of people might be aware or have seen this where General Mark Milley, his testimony to the House Armed Services Committee in response to a question that was asked by Representative Matt Gaetz, who asked the question to the general. The question was, how should the Department of Defense think about critical race theory? And in his response, the general said, quote, "I do think it's important actually for those of us in uniform to be open-minded and be widely read." Then the general went on to say, "I've read Mao Zedong, I've read Karl Marx, I've read Lenin. That doesn't make me a communist. So what is wrong with understanding, having some situational understanding about the country for which we're here to defend," end quote. Now, the general didn't use the term critical thinking or strategic thinking, but I'm wondering if you take his remarks as sort of an endorsement of the type of openness and evaluating the diversity of ideas that you've been an advocate for in the military setting.
Yes. I'll add on to that, and I have to be a little bit careful because we really we protect what people when generals come and talk up here. You know, it's non-attribution, and but I'm pretty safe, I think, in saying that I have heard General Milley say several times that the most important skill for leaders is critical thinking skills. I don't know what drove his answer here, other than to say, why would you not want to know something? And it's not like we're dictating that you have to both read this and then live your life with these assumptions and agree with them. But I have heard General Milley, along with the Chief of Staff of the Army, General McConville, talk about the importance of critical thinking. And you know, and I think part of what it comes from is they spend their life oftentimes as four-star generals going from one 30-minute or 60-minute briefing to another. And I think sometimes they get frustrated with people who are trying to figure out what they want, and then they're not really applying the sound thinking skills that they wish they had applied before they had come in and spent 30 minutes of their time. I'm sure that frustrates them, although they have not said that to me. But to answer your question, Bob, I am really sure that General Milley thinks that critical thinking is, if not the most important, one of the most important skills in his military leaders.
Well, that's beautiful and inspirational to us all, really. Well, Professor Steve Garris, I want to thank you so much for sharing your ideas and your experience with us on Thinking Clearly. And we're going to link to your Army War College webpage and a couple of the papers that we've referenced as we were talking here. Are there any other links that you'd like us to post on our Facebook page?
No, that's fine. Yeah, the critical thinking paper, I think people can, if they didn't understand anything that I was saying today, if they read through that for 25 or 30 minutes, I think they would pick up on it and hopefully it would help them.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
It was great meeting you both and talking to you. It was fun.
And I want to give a big shout out to our listeners. And as always, thank you, Julia. And until next time.
Thank you, Bob.
You're welcome. Keep thinking
clearly. Think for yourself, people. It's your first and your last chance.